Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin and look into the resignation and replacement on the Supreme Court of Justice Souter, and also the confrontation between Condoleezza Rice and students at Stanford, and the possible legal jeopardy of Judge Bybee and others in the Bush administration who authorized torture. We'll be joined by Scott Horton, who's a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He was hired by the Associated Press to represent Bilal Hussein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photographer who was detained without charges by the U.S. military for over a year. He's a professor at Columbia Law School, and he recently led a number of studies of abuse issues associated with the conduct of war on terror for the New York City Bar Association, where he has chaired several committees, including most recently the Committee on International Law. He's the author of over 100 articles and a contributing editor at Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His Harper's weblog, No Comment, is highly regarded, and a wide range of matters from American law and politics to international affairs. He was also the former law partner of the former Attorney General Judge Mukasey. So we'll be talking to Scott Horton about those issues, and then we will examine the outsourcing of torture and the use of contractors with Robert Baer, who spent 25 years running agents from inside the CIA's Directorate of Operations from 1976 to 1997, working against Hezbollah, al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. He is considered by Seymour Hersh as perhaps the best on-the-ground field officer ever to serve in the Middle East. He's the author of a number of bestsellers, including See No Evil, which recounts Bob Baer's years as a top CIA operative. See No Evil was the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Mr. Baer. Robert Baer writes regularly for Time.com, and his most recent book is The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. And then we'll discuss the power of the banking lobby, who Senator Dick Durbin said this week owns the Congress. We'll be talking with Barry Zegers, the Director of Housing Policy at the Consumer Federation of America. And Mr. Zegers has more than 30 years of experience in housing, community, and economic development, including as Senior Vice President at Fannie Mae. So we'll be talking about the defeat of an effort on the part of Senator Dick Durbin to bring about mortgage relief for people, millions of people in this country who are being evicted. I'm now speaking with Scott Horton, who is a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work in international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. As I mentioned, he was hired by the Associated Press to represent Bilal Hussein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who was detained without charges by the U.S. military for over a year. He's a professor of law at Columbia Law School. And, Scott, you're also the former law partner of the former Attorney General, Judge Mukasey. And Judge Mukasey, when some time back, when it was revealed that the CIA destroyed 92 tapes, did he not appoint a special prosecutor, Durham?
He certainly did. John Durham, who is was a career prosecutor in Connecticut, in fact, had handled a number of high-profile cases there, and he appointed him as special prosecutor to look into this matter, and we're seeing movement from Mr. Durham in just the last couple of days.
Describe that, because I've been told by sources that this could be kind of a dark horse, a smoking gun. Choose your analogy.
Well, he's working. I think this man is a consummate professional, and that means, amongst other things, he doesn't pursue his investigation by talking to the media. And it's been very, very difficult to sort of peel back and find out what's going on there. But in the last week, he has convened a grand jury, and he has brought some CIA agents back from the field to testify before the grand jury. And he's also going to be bringing in Philip Zelikow to testify. So that suggests that things are heating up, and he seems to be going after somebody.
Well, let's talk. We'll go back to that subject, obviously, in a little while, Scott Horton. But of course, the big news this week was the resignation of Justice Souter from the Supreme Court. And there's a lot of speculation about his possible successors. First of all, he seems to have hated being in Washington and was never particularly political, he said, until he came to Washington. And I find much of the discussions about the political spectrum on the Supreme Court as being rather fatuous. As far as I can tell, and correct me if I'm wrong, there are no liberals on the Supreme Court. There's nobody in the mold of Brennan, Thurgood Marshall, or certainly William O. Douglas. That basically you have centrists and extreme right wingers.
I agree with that characterization. I mean, certainly if you're taking William O. Douglas or Brennan as the measure of what is a liberal, we don't have any. None of these justices are in that mold. The Clinton appointees are solid centrists, I'd say sort of center-right in Democratic Party terms. And in terms of jurisprudential views, I'd say solid dead center. So we really don't have anybody on the left. And Souter, David Souter, was selected by the first President Bush and was viewed, I think, at that time as someone who really had Bush views, by which I would say, Bush 41, or maybe even better, Prescott Bush, the views of Grandfather Bush, who was a senator from Connecticut. He's sort of a center New England Republican with a rather strong libertarian bent, doesn't like big government, doesn't like government intruding into the life of the citizenry. And, his views have never changed. But the characterization of Souter as a New England Republican then versus as a, quote, liberal, close quote, now has changed. And that's just a question of where one calls the political center. So if you move the political center way to the right, then I suppose you could call him a liberal.
Well, I guess if you're a Republican, if you're not from the South and the dominant group in the House and the Senate, then you are a liberal. I mean, it used to be that Northeastern Republicans were an endangered species. Now they're almost an extinct species.
Well, I would say, but for the two ladies in Maine, they're gone. So Souter's kind of Republican has just disappeared. In fact, I'd say they've made really a beeline for, they've either become Democrats or they've become independents. There really are very, very few of these Northeastern Republicans left, which I think explains in a large measure the current predicament of the Republican Party.
So, Scott Horton, obviously there's a lot of handicapping going on here, and there's some time for Justice Souter has allowed President Obama plenty of time to get this right. It will probably be a bit of a political circus, and preemptively the Republicans will probably try and stop whoever it is. So my question to you would be, well, since there's no liberals on the Supreme Court, why not pick one? And, he's going to get a fight at any rate, so why not make it a good fight?
Solid points, Ian. I mean, I think one thing we can count on is it doesn't matter who Barack Obama nominates. We're going to be hearing in short order from the Weekly Standard and the National Review that person is Satan. They'll be launching all-out war. And I think, and Barack Obama, if you look at the guidance he's given in the past as to, how he's going to pick a Supreme Court nominee, he said, he doesn't want someone who's dogmatic or has doctrinaire views, but he's very concerned about appointing someone to the court who will care about the little man. We really haven't had a justice like that in a very long time. And that might be a way of saying he's going to pick a classical liberal, but not an ivory tower liberal. I mean, he wants someone perhaps who has a background with dirt under the fingernails, who, understands the life of a blue-collar American or a lower-middle-class American.
Well, amongst the women, that seems to be, everybody seems to say they're going to appoint a woman and perhaps get a twofer with a Latino woman, since there are no Latinos on the court. Is there anybody in that field or amongst those that are being put forth that has that kind of working class dirt under the fingernail background?
I think the name that's coming to the top of just about every list right now is Sonia Sotomayor, who was a district court judge here in New York and then went on to the Court of Appeals. She came from the Bronx, and, she knows life at its toughest and most brutal.
She's from Puerto Rican background, right?
That's correct. I think, no doubt about it that she's on the short list of people who are being examined. But, at this point, probably there's a list of a dozen or more candidates who are being given serious examination, and who knows who we'll wind up with at the end. But I think the odds are pretty good right now that it's going to be a woman.
And Scott Horton, again, I'm speaking with Scott Horton, writer, analyst, attorney, professor of law at Columbia Law School, and we're talking about Justice Souter's resignation. I was just dug up a speech the other day that was by Justice Robert Jackson, December the 2nd, 1936, when Roosevelt was reelected. Interesting kind of analogies in the sense that the Democrats were riding high and the Republican Party was in tatters, as everybody now is sort of joking that we no longer have a two-party system, we have a party and a half. But one of the things that he said at this victory dinner, because, you know, Justice Jackson went on to be a Supreme Court justice and was the chief prosecutor at the Nuremberg trials, he said that... he's talking about dirt under the fingernails that you just brought up. We need we offered a fighting faith in talking about the Democratic Party, which clearly has, judging by what happened in the Senate on what happened with the mortgage bill, they're all in the pocket of the bankers now. But we offered a fighting faith in real democracy and economic freedom as well as legal freedom for the working masses. We denied that the injustice and disadvantage under which many people work must be accepted and worshipped as the American way. We believe the soul-killing processes of industry and the cruelties of economic life are capable of improvement. We challenge the doctrine that God stopped his great clock in 1789 when our Constitution was framed, and that he placed on the Supreme Court a duty of seeing that nothing ever moves again.
You know, I think it's a powerful speech that you you quote there. You know, I think this was it was a 1936 speech, wasn't it?
Right, on the victory of Roosevelt's second term.
Right, and I think that was, you know, we've just now seen a party obtain a filibuster-proof veto in the Senate, and that election in 1936 was the last time a political party had accomplished the same sort of leverage in majority. And I think he gives a powerful presentation of this liberal credo from the Roosevelt era. But he also goes on later in the speech to talk about how concerned he is about the collapse of the Republican Party. In fact, he says, you know, one of the great threats I see facing us is that we don't have a credible opposition, and that's not a good thing. He talks about how, you know, the Republican Party no longer seems to have credible leaders, how it no longer has governors or senators who command respect on the public stage. And he says, you know, this means it makes it easier for us to make mistakes as Democrats. So I think he offers some very, very wise counsel on that score, too. And I think the point he's drawing there that, a government needs a good, solid, functioning opposition, you know, that's the sort of argument that John Stuart Mill made. And I think that's a point also that we need to be keeping in mind today, because we're seeing a Republican Party that's just in a state of collapse.
Well, one of the people that always got good press and something of a free ride in the 8 years of the Bush administration was Condoleezza Rice. She was never tarred with the same brush as Bush and Cheney and Rumsfeld, even though she was clearly opportunistic and in a very Shakespearean sense stabbed Colin Powell in the back and didn't support him, who was her natural ally, and made an alliance, if you will, with Cheney and Rumsfeld, and ended up with Colin Powell's job. And she was confronted by students at Stanford, which is an extraordinary exchange. First of all, the most bizarre thing she said, and she said a lot of bizarre things. You know, she said that the insurgency in Iraq was just similar to the Hitler's werewolves at the end of World War II, which proved to be absurd, of course. But this statement that Al Qaeda was worse than the Nazis just isn't. Why does this woman is she treated with so much deference as an intellectual?
Well, the most amazing thing about that exchange to me, and that YouTube is one of the hottest things on the internet right now, about 7 minutes long, is that she lived in an environment in Washington, D.C. for 8 years in which she got fawning treatment and deference from journalists. And now she's returned to Stanford and just goes to reception with some students and is literally torn to shreds. The students are better, much better informed about these events than your typical Washington journalist is, and they have no compunction about asking tough questions and pressing her on them. And you saw she just couldn't stand up to the questioning, and she retreated to some statements that were just delusional. I mean, like the argument that the threat of Al-Qaeda was a much more serious threat to the United States than the threat of the Axis powers during World War II. I mean, you know, we had 405,000 casualties during World War II. And she said America suffered no attack like the attack on the World Trade Center. But indeed, she forgot about Pearl Harbor. And in fact, the number of Americans killed at Pearl Harbor is almost exactly the same as the number of Americans who were killed and the attack on the World Trade Center.
Right, and I believe, I seem to recall, that Hitler declared war on the United States and that German submarines were sinking ships within sight of land on a regular basis.
That's right, and he had teams of scientists working on the preparation of intercontinental missiles, and certainly...
And a long-range bomber as well that could reach New York.
Exactly. So this claim is just completely fatuous. Amazing that a woman who, you know, presents herself as a scholar of history and a political scientist would make statements like that. But, you know, beyond that, you know, they were really closing in with questions about the torture issue.
That she authorized torture. And a student asked her about waterboarding and how she authorized torture, and she responded, "By definition, if it was authorized by the president, it didn't violate our obligations under the Convention Against Torture," which, of course, is such an echo of Nixon's famous...
Nixon Frost. I mean, Nixon said, "When the president does it, that means it is not illegal." And here she is essentially quoting Richard Nixon. You know, of course, Richard Nixon said this behind the screen of a pardon he had in hand. Mm-hmm. And Condoleezza Rice, I mean, they were pressing these questions, of course, because the Senate Intelligence Committee last week declassified and released a schedule that showed the approval process for waterboarding, and it showed that the person who conveyed the authorization for waterboarding was none other than Condoleezza Rice. So she was trying to evade that and didn't do a very good job of it. I think this is something that could come back to haunt her in the future, because there is likely to be one or more criminal inquiries, and her words could easily be taken as an admission of her involvement in a criminal scheme.
Well, there are conspiracy laws, but I mean it's a sort of new twist on the old Nazi justification. I was just following orders. In her case, she says, "I was just passing on orders."
Well, that's right. I mean, that exact defense was used in the Nuremberg trials by a number of senior officials of the government. They say the decisions were taken by the leader or by other senior people, and all I did was relay them, and, you know, to which the answer was guilty, convicted, and you're sentenced to hang. That really wasn't given, much more than short shrift. So that's not a very effective defense, and certainly not very becoming of Condoleezza Rice. She really believes in waterboarding. She should stand her ground and she should defend it. She evidently doesn't want to do that.
So, Scott Horton, we've got Senator Leahy asking Judge Bybee to come out of his chambers where he's sort of hiding out, it seems. What do you think is going to happen to Bybee and then you've got Addington? Apparently there's a huge paper trail between Addington and John Yoo, because Addington apparently was the one that was really telling Yoo what to write and to get it right, you know. So what do you think is going to happen at the end of the day here? Are any of these people, I mean, Larry Wilkerson, Colin Powell's former chief of staff, he thinks that the best we can hope for is that they all get disbarred. What would you think?
Well, first of all, I think, you know, Leahy and his committee, or particularly Sheldon Whitehouse's subcommittee, are going to be having hearings on this. You know, I wouldn't put it beyond them to subpoena Judge Bybee and David Addington to come and answer a bunch of questions. But we're going to see shortly the release of a major study done inside the Justice Department by their Office of Professional Responsibility that's going to talk about who did what in the preparation of these memos. And if it says what I think it's going to say, I think the least of their concerns is going to be being disbarred. I think the bigger concern is going to be criminal prosecution. And indeed, this last week, the criminal court, Central Criminal Court in Spain, formally opened a criminal investigation into the role that these policymakers played in the torture of five Spanish citizens. So we've got a criminal investigation open already. The bigger question is, will we have one in the United States?
And what do you think about the jeopardy of the real authors of all this? Because it becomes clearer and clearer as more and more information comes out that this was all basically ordered from the very top by President Bush and Dick Cheney. And I don't think it's one of those cases where Bush was asleep at the switch and Cheney was the Darth Vader. I think it's sort of in many ways reflects who they are and what their values are.
I think no doubt about it, but that Cheney is the real impetus who's pushing everything. But I think also no doubt that Bush knew and Bush approved, so he's not out of it. I think that's something a prosecutor's got to deal with. The problem, of course, is that when you charge someone at the top of the decision-making pyramid, it looks increasingly like a political act, and that's going to make it more difficult to press the prosecutorial case. But at this point, that certainly can't be ruled out.
Well, returning back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of a kind of dark horse in this story, obviously there's a kind of drip, drip, drip of information coming out about torture. And in many ways, I'm skeptical of a congressional inquiry. If it's going to be anything like the 9/11, we hardly learned anything about, they got Libby, but we didn't learn anything about what was really going on there, the origin of the Niger forgeries. So there's so much that you don't. And as soon as you have a special prosecutor, everything's sealed before a grand jury and it gets dribbled out. So I'm not. I would like to see something that could resolve this extraordinary wound that has taken place in America's reputation and its moral standing.
Well, it seems to me that we've got two separate paths going forward. I mean, one is the criminal justice path that starts with a criminal investigation, and the other is a process of just getting the facts out and establishing what they were, and I think that both paths are going to be taken going forward. I mean, I think we're going to wind up with some sort of formal national inquiry. President Obama says he doesn't want it, but, a large majority of people in the United States, although we have contradictory polls, most of them have said a large majority strongly favor one or the other or both of these accountability measures. So I think we're going to have a process that will aim to get the facts out. And I think when all the facts are out, this is going to really energize a drive for some sort of formal criminal law accountability. Now, that may wind up being things more like lying to Congress and obstructing justice rather than straightforward war crimes prosecutions. But at this point, what we need to do is have a prosecutor appointed and let the investigation start and let the prosecutor take the case where it goes.
I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Scott Horton.
Hey, my pleasure.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Scott Horton, who's a writer, analyst, and attorney known for his work on international law, human rights, and the law of armed conflict. He was hired by the Associated Press to represent Bilal Hussein, a Pulitzer Prize-winning photojournalist who was detained without charges by the U.S. military for over a year. He's a professor at Columbia Law School and the author of over 100 articles, and is a contributing writer to Harper's in Legal Affairs and National Security. His Harper's web blog is No Comment. I'm now speaking with Robert Baer, who spent 20 years running agents from inside the CIA's Directorate of Operations from 1976 to 1997, working against Hezbollah, al-Qaeda, and other terrorist organizations. He is considered by Seymour Hersh as perhaps the best on-the-ground field officer ever to serve in the Middle East. He's the author of a number of bestsellers, Sleeping with the Devil, See No Evil, which became the basis of the acclaimed film Syriana, which earned George Clooney an Oscar for his portrayal of Mr. Baer. Robert Baer writes regularly for Time.com, and his most recent book is The Devil We Know, Dealing with the New Iranian Superpower. And I was just speaking earlier, just a moment ago, with Scott Horton, Bob Baer, who was a former law partner of the former Attorney General Mukasey. And he said that this special prosecutor, John Durham, who Mukasey appointed to look into the destruction of 92 tapes by the CIA, is sort of a dark horse. And in the last few days, there's been some real movement. So Is that one going to catch us by surprise, or I should more importantly catch the former administration by surprise?
I think it probably will, in the sense the CIA destroying evidence in a criminal inquiry. Zacharias Moussaoui is the subject of these 92 tapes, which the CIA destroyed. The defense is saying that this would exonerate their client. The defense asked for these tapes, and in the meantime, the CIA destroyed them. You know, when you bring the CIA into a criminal investigation like this, it really has to follow rules of evidence, and one thing is not destroying tapes like this. And when I was in the CIA, this never happened. Anything that touched on Department of Justice was preserved, sent to the Department of Justice. And any time it wasn't, CIA, like Iran-Contra, went after judicially.
So when is there going to be some clarity on this? I mean, I was very struck by the article in the New York Times last week, My Tortured Decision, by Ali Soufran, who you couldn't find somebody more qualified than him. He, you know, counterintelligence officer with the FBI, the chief interrogator, got to these people before anybody else, and really tells the inside story. And now, at the end of the day, they wouldn't break, the FBI wouldn't break the law, the CIA felt compromised, and eventually it fell to the contractors to do all this stuff. So that seems to be a missing component here.
This is an absolute bombshell. Ali Soufran is a well respected FBI agent. In fact, I talked to a couple FBI friends last week about Ali Soufran. They said he's still very much respected inside the bureau. He's completely objective, and he said the torture didn't work. That Michael Hayden, the former CIA director, is misrepresenting when they got the information, how they got it. It was not extracted through torture. These people were freely talking. It was CIA management, George Tenet, that came in later on and said, no, they're not saying everything they know. Torture them. You also have Bob Mueller, the FBI director, comes out and says torture doesn't work. And this is not bureaucratic wars we're talking about here. This man went on the record twice saying it does not work. What we need to do is actually get the interrogations, the transcripts of them. They need to be made public. We need to be made public the questions asked. Because if it turns out the 9/11 Commission report is all based on tortured information, as you know, Ian, this is just going to open up a world of conspiracy theories and what really happened on 9/11. See, I think 9/11 happened the way the government said it did, but if it's all based on tortured information, I think we need to reopen this.
Well, what's particularly disturbing about some of the more recent revelations is that apparently the Bush administration ordered torture in order to justify their fatally flawed decision to go into Iraq in the first place, based upon a phony connection between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein.
There's that question. They were obviously trying to, and this wasn't just Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind, but there were other people tortured in order to draw this link between Saddam Hussein and 9/11, which we now know did not exist. We know this from documents seized in Baghdad by witnesses, good witnesses. So you really have a tendentious process here, which has gotten us into actually two wars, Afghanistan as well as Iraq. And I don't see how this administration can just say, walk on by, as Peggy Noonan from the Wall Street Journal said. I just don't see how we can do it. These wars are going to be going on for the next 20 years. Americans need to know how we got into them, how we were lied, where our information came from, and who was playing a very deceptive and malicious role in all this. I want to know.
And in terms of the outsourcing, which is has always been out there, but we've never really got a full picture of it. The two things that seem to be need to be explained and fleshed out here are the extent of the outsourcing of torture and the role of the contractors. We know that contractors at CACI were involved at Abu Ghraib, and they were largely responsible. And they the general there, Kapinski, sort of got the junior people took the fall. But Ali Soufran, in his article in the New York Times, mentions that the contractors eventually stepped in when the FBI and the CIA were uncomfortable.
Well, we now know the names of the two contracts. ABC has done a special on them, and they were both former military officers who were peripherally involved in the escape and evasion program of the military called the SEER program, where it's not really about interrogations. It's about what you might receive if you've been captured as a pilot or an American soldier.
So it's basically a survival extension of survival training, isn't it?
It's survival training. That's all it is. But the point is, neither of these two guys, these ex-military guys, had any experience in hostile interrogations. When they picked up Abu Zubaydah and Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they were essentially experimenting at $1,000 a day. So when they waterboarded 163 times Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, they had no idea what they were doing. They also knew nothing about Al-Qaeda, as Ali Soufan said. They had no idea whether these guys, as they were waterboarding, were complying, were telling the truth. They had nothing to compare it with. I mean, the fact that the CIA had to outsource this tells me a couple things. One is the CIA has no experience in hostile interrogations, and I know that, and at least not until 9/11. And we didn't know what we were doing. This was the kind of mentality that we got out of 24, this popular TV program, that there's this ticking bomb, and the only way to find out an answer is to torture, which has completely misled the American people in what torture is about. Torture is a way to intimidate people. Stalin said it. The Spanish Inquisition used torture to intimidate, and everybody else. It is not a way to get intelligence or information.
And if they had to waterboard KSM 183 times, it would indicate that either one, it doesn't work, or two, they didn't. You know, you say they didn't know what they were doing, but it does sort of beg the question of, well, if we have to throw out our principles and take an enormous black eye in the world and end up being poster boys for Al Qaeda. You know, it ought to be worth something.
Al-Qaeda, torture is what Al-Qaeda does, not the United States. Principle aside, I think the best argument to stop the torture, to completely obviate this ever happening again, is to let people know it doesn't work. And secondarily, it destroys our values. This is not what we're about. I'll get an argument on that one. But the point is, we absolutely wasted all the goodwill we had after 9/11 with Abu Ghraib and the torture, completely wasted it. We have become, in a sense, a pariah state. And we're not only going to see, I think, investigations here, I think we're going to see indictments in Europe of Bush officials. They will not be able to travel to Europe.
Well, apparently the Spanish judge has already taken up the case.
Well, as he should. You know, Ian, the thing is, look, we got Milosevic in jail and other people for war crimes. Why should the United States be different? This is what the Europeans are asking, and it's a good question.
So it's pretty clear that this we're talking about way up the chain, up to the president and Cheney, and it, I think in many ways it's beginning to look like this kind of reckless amateurism, this lethal combination of ignorance and arrogance, which so characterized the former president and vice president, really is. You can lay it all at their door, but of course that's never happened before, and that's you're not going to see a president and a vice president in shackles on a perp walk. So who's going to pay the price? We already know that the small fish at Abu Ghraib paid the price, and many of them are now blaming the president, saying how come the president ordered all this and we're taking the fall. So who's going to be in the perp walk, do you think?
Well, I agree with Scott Horton completely. What we need to do is get the facts out. Wilkerson, Powell's former aide, said that 100 people have been actually killed during these interrogations, maybe more. I don't know if that figure is correct, but I've certainly heard it thrown around Washington. We have to find out what happened before we can actually sit down and ascribe blame, because it could be much worse than we think. Again, I go back to those 92 tapes destroyed by the CIA. A CIA officer who saw those tapes said they had to be destroyed. They were so horrific. there was, if they'd been shown to the public, there would have been no doubt this was torture, and the the legal retribution would have gone on endlessly. So the CIA, in a calculated decision, decided to destroy these tapes, and that kind of thing. We need to find out. We need a truth and reconciliation.
So. Bob Baer, when you go on Fox and make these kind of arguments, do you think you're making any headway? I mean, the apparently polls are indicating that there is a slow process of education going on here with the American people. Initially, they all supported the simplistic 24 kind of notion of the ticking bomb and you got to do anything possible to stop the next attack. Now they're beginning to recognize that this we paid a terrible price for this gratuitous, incompetent immorality.
The only way we can stop this from happening again is people like Ali Soufan, Bob Mueller, is we need the facts out there. We don't need an ex-CIA guy like me saying, listen, this is what I've seen over the years. Torture doesn't work. We actually need the facts. And I think once they are shown to the American people, the chances of this happening again are remote. I mean, there could be another attack, but if the American people understand that torture doesn't work, they won't even consider it. They'll solve it in a different way, in a way that works.
Well, just in closing, Bob Baer, if 9/11, that commission is going to be a model, or if indeed the Fitzgerald inquiry into the outing of Valerie Plame, neither of those were particularly satisfactory. What kind of an inquiry would you want?
I think we need a blue ribbon commission of people that can be trusted. It cannot be done in the Senate or the House. It cannot be done by a prosecutor because a prosecutor is only looking for legal evidence to indict. We need the facts out there, and it needs to be people we trust. And there are people. We've got generals, retired politicians, academics should be looking at the facts, and as much information as possible should be declassified. There's no reason we can't take Abu Zubaydah's interrogation transcripts and make them public. We already know the name of the source. We already more or less know everything he said, but let's actually see the facts and let people reasonable judge them.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Robert Baer.
Thanks, Ian.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking of Robert Baer, who spent 20 years running agents from inside the CIA's Directorate of Operations from 1976 to 1997. Let's now turn to the subject of the extent to which the bankers, these discredited people that are now called banksters by many people, are still in control of the Congress, and as, according to Senator Dick Durbin, they own the Congress. I'm speaking with Barry Zegers, who's Director of Housing Policy at the Consumer Federation of America. Mr. Zegers has spent more than 30 years of experience in housing, community, and economic development, including as Senior Vice President at Fannie Mae and leading the National Low Income Housing Coalition, a national nonprofit advocacy organization. He helped create innovations such as the Low Income Housing Tax Credit and HOME, the HOME program, H-O-M-E, and affordable single-family mortgage products that have helped to significantly expand affordable home ownership and rental housing opportunities for low- and moderate-income Americans. He is a trustee of Enterprise Community Partners and serves on the board of Mercy Housing, Inc., the National Housing Trust, and the National Housing Conference. And we have a crisis here in the United States where many people are being thrown out of their homes. Many are living in their cars. This week in the Senate, there was an attempt to bring about some mortgage relief so that people wouldn't be evicted because there are many, many houses about to foreclose. And the Senate was unable to vote. The bill was carried and with some vigor by Dick Durbin. But he lamented that the banking lobby is too powerful. And they own the Congress. Is it as bleak as that?
Well, it was a very disappointing vote. The amendment that Senator Durbin proposed to a larger housing and banking bill that was on the floor would have created an opportunity for borrowers under certain specific circumstances who were forced into bankruptcy to have their mortgage liens modified by bankruptcy judges. After many weeks of negotiations that Senator Durbin led, with major financial institutions and advocates, the final compromise really placed the onus of this squarely on banks. If they offered consumers The modifications that were established by the administration recently, and we can talk about those in detail later, but if consumers had been offered those modifications, then they could not seek modification of the mortgage later in bankruptcy court. So this was something that really gave lenders the opportunity to do the right thing by consumers and only had the bankruptcy modification as a last resort and only over the next couple of years. It was a stinging defeat and very disappointing that the banking industry could not come to agreement with Senator Durbin.
Well, but Senator Durbin's response is that they have this extraordinary power, and with a vote of 51 to 45, with 12 Democrats joining all the Republicans in opposing the proposal, this is also happening at a time where the United States taxpayer is bailing out the banks. I'm surprised that the political climate is such that these senators can get away with it. Where is the populist outrage?
Well, I think you've put your finger right on it. I think a couple of things come out of this. One is the administration, which has stepped in to bail out the banks in a way that's not very different than consumers were seeking to be able to get modifications to their mortgages as a last resort in bankruptcy. These institutions need to be brought to heel. The administration has been working with them collaboratively, has offered to help pay for the modifications that would have eliminated the opportunity for bankruptcy modification if lenders offered it. And in return, the bankers have basically thumbed their noses at the administration. So I think first, the administration needs a little more steel in the velvet glove to emphasize to these institutions that the support of the United States government doesn't come for free. Second, a number of the Democrats in the Senate, I think, who voted against this decided that it was easier to accede to the banking industry's wishes than it was to stand up for consumers, particularly because in most of the states, these senators represented, foreclosures are not the overwhelming problem they are in states like California, Florida, the Midwest, and other places. And so senators whose constituents are being hammered by this mortgage crisis did the right thing and voted with Senator Durbin. I think just a number of Democrats felt that the price they'd have to pay ultimately was not high enough to buck the banking lobby. And the banking lobby throws a lot of money around, has offices and agents in all states, and it's just a real illustration that even today, with so many consumers on the ropes, that the banking lobby pulls a lot of weight in Congress.
Well, there's a new word in the lexicon now, banksters, which I see coming up. So it's pretty clear that a lot of people out there in the public are not looking very kindly upon the banking community. One of the senators, the Democrats who voted for the bill, of course, is Senator Tom Carper of Delaware, which is a big banking center. But still, even people like Ben Nelson, in his district, there's going to be a lot of foreclosures. It's not as if they're getting off scot-free in terms of not supporting their constituents in distress.
No, it's not. And, you know, I hope a reckoning will come. It's also, frankly, very, very perplexing to me that the large banks, with the exception of Citigroup, which agreed to an even more stringent proposal some months ago and stayed in the game and continued to support these changes as they were made. So I want to give Citigroup credit. But the other big lenders, J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Wells Fargo, these banks, it's inexplicable to me why in the end they couldn't support the Durbin Amendment actively, because it was a very modest proposal at the end, and it gave banks really, were in the driver's seat. If they offer consumers the modifications in the Obama plan, then those consumers would not be able to seek modifications later in bankruptcy. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that going into bankruptcy, Chapter 13 bankruptcy, for any consumer is no walk in the park, number one. It's very tough. It puts people under severe constraints for a number of years afterwards, and it ruins their credit for quite a long time. It's very painful. It's very difficult. And nobody in the consumer advocacy arena suggests that this is a path that consumers choose as their first option to try to find a way to modify their mortgage. It is a last resort. And the Durbin bill would have realigned the incentives for lenders to participate actively to modify mortgages with borrowers before they got to that pass. And that's what's so tragic about this defeat, is that in the end, the Durbin Amendment would not have allowed consumers who had been offered or taken these earlier modifications to do so again in bankruptcy. And why banks could not agree to that is for me, to me, very inexplicable. And I think it just gets down to the banking lobby was unwilling to agree to changes in bankruptcy of any kind because their view of bankruptcy is that it should be tough on consumers and good for creditors. By and large, that is the purpose of bankruptcy. But in the crisis we're confronting with consumers suffering from mortgages that these banks made, financed, and serviced, many of which have predatory features and unfair features, it's unreasonable and unfair for the banks to have opposed this amendment. We're very disappointed.
Again, I'm speaking with Barry Zegers, the Director of Housing Policy at the Consumer Federation of America. And Mr. Zegers has more than 30 years of experience in housing, community, and economic development, including as a senior vice president at Fannie Mae. Of course, the one of the few domestic achievements of President Bush in his 8 years was the passing of the bankruptcy bill that overhauled bankruptcy and made it much, much more difficult for the consumer, the debtor, and much, much more profitable, if you will, for the banks, the holders of mortgages. And the same banking lobby that we're talking about was the banking lobby that weighed in on that new bankruptcy bill. But that notwithstanding, Barry Zegers, still it is, and I can see that you're just as puzzled as I am, the Durbin Amendment would have made it a win-win, because when these banks toss these people out on the street and then they sell the houses at fire sale prices and lose on an average about 50%, this bill would have kept people in their homes and they would have been servicing the mortgages, albeit perhaps at a lower rate. And many of the trickery that went on in these subprimes would be modified and should be modified.
Well, the biggest objection that lenders have had to the modification of these loans in bankruptcy is that it would have given judges the authority to reduce the principal, right? It could have crammed down, is the phrase, outstanding principal on the mortgage to bring it to a level that might be affordable by the consumer in an overall realignment and restructuring of their debts. And this is a sticking point for the lenders. The irony and the tragedy of this is that for borrowers who had been offered a much more modest modification proposal opportunity consistent with what the president has proposed, which offers principal reduction only as a last resort at the option of the lender, they could have escaped any need to address that later on in bankruptcy. So you'll have to really speak to the banking lobby about what their reasons for this were. But the sticking point has always been this unwillingness to accept the principle that a first lien on a house can be crammed down in a bankruptcy modification. Ironically, first liens only fell under this prohibition in 1978 at a time when mortgage lending looked significantly different than it does today. The principal means of borrowing money for a home was a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage. Lenders argued that in return for that kind of loan, which was a stable, steady, long-term debt, it should not be subject to modification and bankruptcy. Today, of course, many of these consumers who are in such trouble are confronting short-term ARMs, adjustable-rate mortgages, which have high resets. They have no interest, no documentation, no verification loans. They have all kinds of bells and whistles on them, which make them much more like the rest of consumer finance that is modifiable in bankruptcy. And, of course, if you have a mortgage on a second home and you go into Chapter 13 bankruptcy, the bankruptcy judge can modify that loan, but not the one for the house in which you're living. So going forward, I think we're just going to have to redouble our efforts. This was always designed to realign interests in the equation, not to promote bankruptcy as a means of modifying mortgages, but only to give consumers a fair shake, and make sure lenders understood that if they fail to step up to the plate and offer modifications beforehand, they could be faced with the threat of doing so by a bankruptcy judge. And that threat has effectively not been put in place because of the Senate's action. The House did pass a much tougher bankruptcy reform provision. We have to wait and see whether in a conference the House sends that back and insists on a negotiation. But right now, this has been a big setback for consumers.
And Barry Zegers, isn't it true when you talk about the cram down, that, in effect, the property values have dropped so precipitously that these probably 9 times out of 10, these houses are worth much less than the mortgage, isn't it?
In most cases, that's going to be true today. Mm-hmm. And it's likely to be true for some time into the future. Of course, for borrowers who are current on their mortgages or can receive assistance through these various modification plans that have been proposed by the administration, it's possible they will be able to remain current on their mortgage, cure their current delinquency, and over time, the value of the house is going to rise to where it is worth as much as the mortgage or more. We don't really know what that future holds, and of course, many homeowners today do not face this problem, but a large number do. Going forward, this is just going to make the process of resolving the foreclosure crisis much more difficult and much more painful. It's ironic that all of these big lenders who would not agree to support the Durbin Amendment have all signed contracts with the government to begin offering modifications a la the Obama plan, which is exactly what the Durbin bill required and would have used as a safe pass to avoid further modifications later in bankruptcy. Why they could not agree to this is baffling.
Well, what do you think is going to happen with the credit card modification bills that are in the House? A substantial majority passed it. Will the Senate behave the same way and act as Dick Durbin suggested, as though they're totally in the pocket of the banking lobby?
I don't know. I think there is broad support for the credit card reforms because there's been so much documented abuse by lenders in terms of the junk fees and raising interest rates on credit cards because of a delinquency on some other debt, not on the credit card. And I think there's a strong undercurrent of opposition to the large banks being able to continue to operate in this fashion. But we're just going to have to wait and see.
Well, it's an extraordinary business, isn't it? I don't know whether you're a lawyer, but I understand that credit cards are about the only contract that anybody can have that can be changed, abrogated by the credit card company at will. The consumer, is the reason why the consumer is getting hosed here and doesn't have any protection, is that because there isn't a kind of an ombudsman or any kind of in other words, is it because the banking lobby is so powerful that they've stripped out any rights that consumers have? Because they can, a credit card company can raise your credit, you can have the best rating of all, pay your bill religiously and have a high ceiling, and suddenly you find that your ceiling has been cut down and your rates have gone up, and it's completely unilateral.
These abuses or these conditions you've just described, are the subject of regulation that the Federal Reserve has adopted. The legislation you've described would accelerate the adoption of these rules. The Fed has put them out a couple of years, ostensibly to give banks an opportunity to retool their systems and adjust. And Congress is impatient, and Congress would like to see these changes adopted now. Senator Dodd, for instance, has been a champion of consumers in the credit card arena for a long time. I'm not a lawyer, and I'm not actually an expert on credit cards, but this legislation is strongly supported by Consumer Federation and all the consumer advocacy organizations, because we do think in this crisis has highlighted the degree to which consumers are at the mercy of large banks when they take out this credit, often do not understand the terms, and to your point, find themselves unilaterally subject to interest rate increases, junk fees, late fees, and other kinds of devices that lenders use to boost their bottom lines at the expense of consumers who are sold these cards as a kind of a cost-free access to credit. There's no doubt that access to credit cards has been a revolution in helping consumers buy things on credit and use their own credit in effective and intelligent ways. It's also true that many consumers get sucked into using this credit in ways that are not helpful to them, and that these fees, particularly in the current environment, can be a significant part of that. The Federal Reserve has recognized that and has proposed and adopted rules that would rein in some of this behavior, and Congress simply wants to accelerate that and get these rules in place sooner.
Well, indeed. I mean, all the one thing that all the major religions have in common is they're all have injunctions against usury, whether it's Islam, Christianity, or Judaism. And it's interesting when you consider that the kind of interest rates that people are paying on their credit cards would, by any definition, be usury.
Well, I'm no religious expert either, but the banks have had a long run at this, and for many years, these excesses went unattacked. But I think that day is over, and we're hopeful that as this legislation moves through the House and Senate, that we're going to see genuine reform adopted sooner rather than later.
Well, Barry Zegas, I'm glad that you're out there and that the Consumer Federation of America is standing up for the consumer, because it doesn't look like our politicians are.
Well, let's you have to be an optimist to be in this business, and I think this defeat of the bankruptcy amendment has thrown things into starker relief, perhaps, than they were in the past. And I hope it'll stimulate a firmer hand by the administration to step in. You've noted that the American taxpayer today is supporting all of these institutions, some of whom would themselves be in bankruptcy court if it wasn't for the government's intervention. So it seems only fair to expect them to step up and treat the consumer fairly. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're hoping will happen.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles today, Barry Zegas.
Ian.
And hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I was just speaking there with Barry Zegas, who's Director of Housing Policy at the Consumer Federation of America. He was formerly a Senior Vice President at Fannie Mae. I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, and the Associate Producer, Elliot Fong, the Assistant Producer, Janie Coolidge, the Engineer, G.